Hello everyone to another episode of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour Blah. This is Stefan Sasse, contributor to the Tower of the Hand and creator of the A Dance with Dragons reread blog. And today is with me, as always...
It's Sean T. Collins. I am the creator of All Leather Must Be Boiled at BoiledLeather.com, which is the blog where you probably found this podcast. I also cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone, and co-wrote the annotated Game of Thrones for the Subtext iPad app. And today we are having a two-part discussion, which wasn't our plan initially. We're only going to talk about one topic, but last night Game of Thrones aired the Blackwater episode, and we pretty much have to talk about it.
Yeah, most definitely. When I watched the Blackwater episode and it was finally done and this version of The Reigns of Castamere went with the credits, I sat on my couch and I was still awestruck by what I just had witnessed on live television, so to speak, because I would never have thought that they would pull it in the way they did. I mean, there were several outstanding things, and I'm sure we will discuss some of them now, but one is the structure itself, because the episode really does only cover the Battle of the Blackwater, and I would never have believed that they would take an entire episode only for the battle. There are no deviations, no wall, no Arya, no Daenerys, it's just the battle and what happens in it. So, what were your impressions?
Well, I think that was important, and... It's actually not something I really even talked about in my review for Rolling Stone, which at the time of this recording isn't up yet. And I think it's because I felt like I had to focus so much, just like the episode did. I didn't really have time to even mention that the other storylines hadn't been featured at all. But it's true, and you know, they can get away with it because there are so many characters involved in the battle on either side. You know, they do... there's a lot of different storylines come together, but you know, that sense that you are trapped in King's Landing or on these ships or on that battlefield with these characters is very important. And if they had cut away to show us, you know, meanwhile in Carth, meanwhile at the Wall, meanwhile, you know, in the Riverlands, it wouldn't have had that claustrophobic no way out feeling that I think was very, very important to conveying what was going on for the characters involved.
Most definitely. And speaking about the characters, I really was impressed by how much Lena Headey managed to pull Cersei off. I mean, many have complained about the performance of Headey in the role of Cersei, or at how Cersei is portrayed by the writers of the episode, but in this episode she really stepped up to the plate. I mean, this was Cersei. I just had this feeling that she was such a strong performance in this episode. I really was, well, blown away by it.
Yeah, I agree. I wrote that, you know, that it's her finest hour, literally. It was her finest episode. You know, there's sort of a gallows humor that comes out in her that we'd never seen before. You know, I think we can sort of see her misery at her situation in life, where because of the fact that she was born a woman, she's trapped in this lifestyle, you know, where she's, instead of learning how to kill, she learns how to curtsy. You know, she's traded like livestock, like a horse, as she says, by her own father. You know, and if the city falls, you know, she's going to get plundered like gold or treasure would. You know, she's just a commodity to both her allies and her enemies. And you can see the way that a lifetime of dealing with that and being embittered and angered by it, you know, sort of comes exploding out as the war and the amount of wine that she drinks to sort of escape the war, you know, sort of break down her very, very carefully constructed shields. You know, I think it's funny that they had her in this sort of Valkyrie gold breastplate armor, because her actual armor just almost came completely crashing down, and to see all this, you know, rage underneath was really, really fascinating. And you're absolutely right, it was Headey's best moment on the show by far.
and they even managed to top it again in the end, in this scene where she has Tommen on her lap on the Iron Throne in this completely deserted throne room, and tells him the story of the cup and prepares to give him the poison. I mean, I was just sitting there, and I mean, I know the story, Tommen is not going to be poisoned, but in this scene, they were so strong that I genuinely wasn't sure whether she would perhaps kill him or not. I think it was really the first time in the whole show that I was not sure about the way they were going, where a genuine feeling of suspense came up. Not the, that the rest would be boring or something, but I hope you get across what I mean.
Absolutely. It's such a different show than any of the other shows that I watch and really care about, or have watched, by which I mean the list that I always give: The Sopranos, Twin Peaks, Deadwood, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Lost, Battlestar Galactica, The Wire, because these are all shows that I'm watching with the same sort of rapt attention I'm giving Game of Thrones, but I have no idea what's going to happen, because there's no source material that I've already read and really familiarized myself with, and Game of Thrones, as good as it is, lacks that element of surprise that I find to be such a key component of why I enjoy those other shows. I mean, I've described those other shows, sort of the main way I praise them is that, you know, when I sit down, I have no idea what I'm going to see by the time the final credits roll. And as good as Game of Thrones is, that's not the case, usually. But you're right, you know, the fact that they've deviated as much as they have from the books this season made it possible for them to create this moment of genuine suspense, not just for newcomers to the material, but for people like you and me, who know this stuff backwards and forwards. I thought, like you, maybe she's going to kill Tommen. You know, maybe they won't make it in on time. I had no idea. They'd obviously have to change a lot of the story down the line, I assume. You know, Tommen really still hasn't come into his own. You know, the whole marriage with Marjorie, there was a lot they were going to have to change, but I thought they would go for it. That's how fearless the show seems at this point. And I found myself really breathing a sigh of relief when Loras and Tywin came into the throne room. I was nervous for Tommen there.
Which is a feat by the producers of the show that has its own merit, when you are relieved when Tywin and Loras enter the room.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, another wonderful thing about this battle was a couple episodes ago when Stannis said that, you know, when I take King's Landing and take the throne, Davos will be his hand. I thought that was a really smart way of taking two very sympathetic characters, certainly the most sympathetic character in both of those two sides of the war, Davos and Tywin, and pitting them against one another so that audience loyalties would be divided. You know, because you probably don't like Stannis very much, and you certainly don't like Cersei and Joffrey and most of the rest of Team Lannister very much. But you do like Davos, and you do like Tyrion, but only one of them is going to be the hand in the end, you know, we know. Only one of them may survive, only one of them, you know, is going to be on the winning side. And it was very smartly done to sort of divide your loyalty like that and make you end up rooting for characters you don't like and sometimes rooting against characters you do sort of like. You know, I think another thing they did there that was smart was making Stannis participate in the battle. I think it would have been very hard for television viewers to understand why he wouldn't participate in this attack and then have any sympathy for him at all going forward if he commanded from the rear, which he did in the books, you know, for good reason. All of the kings and leaders who command from the rear in the books do it for good reason. You don't want to get killed. And you are literally more important than an average foot soldier. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's true. But I don't think the television audience would have been able to forgive that when all these other characters are going through, you know, a living hell in person. It would have been... You could never have sympathized with Stannis again if he had just sat back and watched it all happen. So I think you're right, that the way they played with our sympathies with characters like Tywin and Stannis and Tyrion and even the Hound, for example, it was very, very smart filmmaking.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting that you mention Stannis going into the battle, because there was the one moment in this episode where I wasn't exactly sure what to think of it. I wasn't that positive about it when I saw it, because it just seemed to be Stannis at all, how he climbed the wall and started to kill people by himself and took on two or three guards and... But I guess you're right, it's the best way for a non-book reader audience to relate to the character at all.
Yeah.
So I guess I have to look it over and just revel in the explosion on the Blackwater.
Yes. Oh, can I talk about that explosion, please?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I sat there with my jaw open. I mean, it was literally jaw-dropping for me, the wildfire explosion. And it had to be, because there had been so much build-up, not just throughout the whole season and the references to pig shit and all that stuff, but, you know, just in the episode alone, there had been all this talk, you know, between Tyrion and Joffrey and between Davos and Mathos about there's no ships, where are the ships, why is there only one ship? So, you know, even a newcomer knew something was going to happen, something big. But it really had to be huge to make all that build-up worthwhile, because otherwise you would have thought, oh, there's much ado about nothing.
Yeah.
But it was so big, it was so much bigger even than I imagined while reading the Battle of the Blackwater in A Clash of Kings over the years. And, you know, obviously the battle in the books is at a much larger scale. There's, you know, there's hand-to-hand fighting on ships, and there's the whole bridge of ships, and there's catapults, and all those things. You know, there's fighting in the sea, you know, there's fighting on both banks. There's a lot of, you know, there's a whole Lannister fleet instead of the one decoy ship. So they had to reduce the scale. Understand, there's more than one gate that's attacked. They had to reduce the scale. I understand that. But the explosion itself... you know, the color, the way that Neil Marshall, who's an excellent director, whose work I look forward to even when he's not directing Game of Thrones, the way he filmed the initial explosion, the blast wave that knocked out Mathos and Davos, and knocked them right out of the episode. The way the ship disintegrated almost plank by plank, and just that massive fireball... just getting, anytime you see it, it's still getting bigger, and the sort of streaming shrapnel flaming out into the sky. It was so huge and beautiful and awesome in the sense that it was awe-inspiring. I couldn't be happier with it. And once you've nailed that spectacle, I think so much of your work is done for you. And there's a tendency among critics to reduce the importance of spectacle or of, you know, of whatever sort, effects-based or, you know, gore, sex. But I think a lot of these things are meant to jar you out of the story and sort of impact you on just a visual, visceral level. And that's a way that the power of the story is communicated without actually using dialogue or any of the other storytelling tools. So I find spectacle very important to filmmaking, and this was as good as it gets.
Definitely. Just to bring one final thought on the matter, which will lead us to our main topic for the podcast, I think what they also nailed in the episode was the level of gore and violence. It was never cheesy or just showing off, like in the horror movies, you know, oh my god, we opened the stomach, look at this, what we can do in terms of violence. It just transported a sense of how violent such a battle is, of how brutal it is. The people crying, especially after the explosion of the wildfire, you had an awful amount of crying people burning to death, and people getting hit by stones or debris all over the place, instead of just being knocked over by the sword of the Hound or something. So that was really transporting the sense of war as an ugly, messy business, which is just brutal and nothing heroic or something like that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that was basically my point.
Oh, yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the sound of the screaming and the cries after the explosion, because it wasn't just your usual sort of fantasy battle roar. You know, people, it was screams of high-pitched agony. I was really impressed that they did that, that it wasn't just some sort of abstract thing. You could hear the pain in people's voices, which I think is absolutely crucial. And you're right. I mean, Martin has talked about how he tries to convey both the horror of war and the glory of war. But the glory of war is an aspect of the horror, because that, you know, you can't help but be attracted to something that you know is sort of grinding up human lives. And you never, he never loses sight of that, neither did the show. I thought it was really telling that the one big heroic Lord of the Rings style moment, you know, of the sort of charge of the horses, the save the day at the last minute, was something that Tyrion sees as he collapses to the ground, you know, bleeding to death from a sword to the face. You know, I think that's very telling too.
Yes,
that it's a horrible business, and even when it is sort of sweeping and thrilling, you know, the odds are that you're dying as you witness that aspect of it. So. Yeah, they don't mess around with it at all.
Yeah, definitely. So, this brings us to our main topic of the podcast, which is children and violence. We thought that this would be a most fitting topic, because it is a topic that comes up often during the books, because there is much violence going on, obviously, and children are victims to this violence more often than not, especially in the storylines of Arya, and I think to an extent in Brienne's storyline, we can witness such violence against the most helpless of people more than once, and it really lets A Song of Ice and Fire stand out not only in fantasy but generally in fiction, because this is such an ugly topic that brings about the worst emotions in us, that really ties knots in our guts when we read about it. And so I think we have to get a bit deeper into it, both on a literary level, so what does it do with the story, and what does it tell us about the world in itself.
Yeah, it's something that I had been thinking a lot about this season. This season of the show, and I'm also rereading the books at the same time, and I'm also just sort of looking at current events in the world, and it just felt like it needed to be discussed. I mean, 4 out of the 9 episodes we've seen so far of season 2 end with children being killed. You had the massacre of the bastards, you had Craster sacrificing his son, infant son, to the White Walkers. You had the Lannister forces killing Lami, and you had the display, the really gruesome display of the lynched, burned bodies of the two boys at Winterfell by Theon. And, you know, so with that in mind, as I reread the books, which I'm still in the middle of doing, you know, while the season went on, I was struck by how many times the murder of children is, if not quite a narrative turning point, then like a sign that something has gone really wrong with whoever is doing it. You know, the most obvious example is Jaime tossing Bran out the window. Bran lives, but that was the moment when I was like, wow, what am I reading? You know, I was surprised by it on a literary level. But it also, that's how you learn that the Lannisters are the bad guys, at least at first. But it happened over and over again. And even in the past, you know, the sort of signature crime of the sack of King's Landing by the Lannister forces is the murder of Princess Elia's children by Amory Lorch and Gregor Clegane. The crime that leads to the death of Lord Karstark and sort of the beginning of the end for the North is the Karstarks killing the child prisoners, the young Lannister prisoners that had been captured. The crime that convinces Daenerys to overthrow the slavers at Astapor is how they train the Unsullied by having them murder babies that they rip from their mother's arms. the slavers at Marine end up being crucified in exchange, you know, in response to their crucifixion of child slaves. Obviously, Theon and what he does to, you know, ostensibly Bran and Rickon, but are actually, you know, two, you know, innkeeper's children. You know, and I could probably keep going. I just happened to stop there. But I was really surprised. That's the clearest signal that characters get, and that we readers get, that that the force who's done it is capable of doing horrible things. It just is it's a recurring theme that I'd never noticed before.
Yeah, the way you put it is really striking out. I never had thought about it in that detail. I'm just rereading A Clash of Kings also, and I came by the sequence where Arya and the rest of the Night's Watch recruits are attacked by Armory Lodge. And in this scene particularly, you have this intensity of fighting increased at least tenfold by the fact that Armory Lodge and his guys are killing little boys, basically. You have this scene where one of the recruits is beaten after they battered down the gate, and he is on his knees pleading for mercy and gets a spiked mace right in the face. And descriptions like this, it's not just he kills the guy or something, but he hits him right in the face with a mace, you know? It's the sheer brutality of it.
Yeah.
You have come to grips in all kind of fiction with people getting killed. There is, with the exception of romantic comedies, I think, literally no fictional subgenre without people getting killed. And in most action movies, the hero and the bad guy, they simply shoot people, or in fantasy, they are hit with a sword and then they are dead. I mean, how many orcs have you seen just injured in The Lord of the Rings? They are killed normally. It's a fairly clean process. You hit them once and their health points drop below zero and they're dead. And that is not the case in A Song of Ice and Fire. Here, death is a much more gruesome affair. It's more realistic. And normally you don't think about stuff like this. How hurtful it must have been to be in a battle with medieval weapons, because it's not like you are hit in the heart by a bullet or something. You are hit with maces and swords and clubs and pierced by arrows, and in the fewest cases this will have resulted in an instant death. And if these are children especially, and it seems very common that children are in combat, several characters state that the pages and the squires, they are in battles too, and they are children in most of the cases, and they die. It's even Rickard Karstark's ultimative argument. So this is a world where it has been normal to kill even children, because death is normal generally, but it even extends to the realm of children. And that seems a very powerful theme to me, one that is layered down in regards to other themes who are much more prominently placed, but this one follows us through all of the novels.
Yeah, and one example I had just left off that I just remembered is the reason Dany locks up her dragons is because Drogon kills a child.
Yes.
You know, which, again, another turning point for her and for that whole storyline. That wouldn't have happened if that hadn't happened. And it's a way, you're right, I think it is buried in terms of its prominence, you know, because like I said, it's something that I don't think either of us had really thought of in quite these terms. I was reading, there's an essay collection coming out called Beyond the Wall that analyzes various aspects of Game of Thrones by different writers, and I have a review copy. And Alyssa Rosenberg, who's a fine pop culture critic who writes for Think Progress, did an essay about the use of sexual violence and rape as a weapon of war. And she makes the argument, which I found very persuasive, that the way the different factions or cultures handle or view or handle rape is sort of our indicator and the sort of no inherently good characters indicator of the value of that society. And I think that's very true, but I also think it's true of this. You know, and it's just funny to me because I've thought about the role of misogyny and sexism in the world and in the story a lot, but I never really thought of the way that violence against children communicates so much about the characters before. And I think that it's part and parcel with what you said about how the books don't skimp on showing us what medieval violence really means. You know, I have to say that I think the show has actually done a very good job of that, that when they have these fight scenes, you know, I think the first one that I really remember being quite struck by was Bronn's duel with Ser Vardis in the Eyrie. The way the fights are choreographed, you never lose sight of the fact that basically these are just two guys with big, heavy, sharp chunks of metal trying to cut pieces of each other off, you know? Like, it's really personal and intense. And, you know, I think that when you unleash that kind of violence on a society-wide level in war, it's only natural that the most vulnerable members of that society will be targeted, because water finds its level, shit flows downhill, and if you have set this big machine in motion that does nothing but kill, the people who are easiest to kill are going to get killed. It just happens. And like I said earlier, looking around at current events going on in the world at the same time as I'm watching the show and rereading the books, you know, this is very true in the real world too. I mean, you know, just in the amount of time that this has been going on, you had Sergeant Bowles, Sergeant Robert Bales, an American soldier who went around in an Afghan village murdering children in their beds in their sleep. You had, this was actually a little before, but Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an American who's an American citizen, but an anti-American cleric and alleged member of Al-Qaeda. Not only was he killed by a drone strike in Afghanistan, but so was his teenage son and his teenage nephew. You had, you know, all sorts of drone strikes kill children in Pakistan and Afghanistan all the time. You had a fake, this was last year during Game of Thrones, but you had a fake children's vaccination program that the American government had a Pakistani doctor do in Pakistan, where he pretended to start vaccinating children for hepatitis B, but he was actually taking DNA samples to find the Bin Laden family, and once they found him, they stopped the fake vaccination program, and they went in and killed Bin Laden. But meanwhile, children had gotten incomplete vaccinations, and you know, and even here in the States, not in a war zone, you had George Zimmerman shoot Trayvon Martin to death, a teenage kid returning from a convenience store whose only crime apparently was being black. So these things happen all the time in real life. Even just this weekend, there was the Hula massacre in Syria. I bring that up last because I personally find it important to point out that whatever our intentions here in America, we have the blood of a lot of children on our hands as well. It's not going to get covered as dramatically, particularly here in America, as the massacre in Syria, you know, but it happens on all sides all the time. And I just am so impressed that Game of Thrones manages to be this entertaining, engrossing, fascinating, delightful, epic fantasy, but still does not shy away from showing, you know, this sort of most horrible aspect of war, which is that the most vulnerable members of society are killed all the time.
Yeah, I think we have two levels here in in understanding why this is such a phenomenon in Westeros. The first is really obvious, because in Westeros we are in a society that has not yet managed to make any difference between a soldier and a civilian. There is no real difference between wartime and peacetime, or between fighting people and non-fighting people. Whoever gets in a fight is fair game, and the Geneva Convention has yet to be written, and something like professional army is still to be involved, to be invented. So if the war comes to a village, everyone in that village is an enemy or a source of food or whatever. So that's the first, the more obvious problem. The second thing is that the Westerosi society does not really have a concept of childhood and children, in my opinion. That's my great theory about this. Because you have, obviously, children so little that they can't even walk and talk and stuff. You can't do anything else than regard them as children, but they are so incomplete, so totally helpless, that they are not regarded as human beings on the same level as you are. I think people in Westeros have only two kinds of humans they see. Humans that are equal to them in terms of what they are capable in doing, walking, talking, eating, perhaps even get their livelihood by themselves. And people who can't. And I think the borderline between these two categories is about 6 to 8 years, I would guess. Then you can start collecting your own food and stuff, and beginning with that, you're fair game, basically. There is no concept of a childhood like we have it, that is to be secluded from the realm of the adults. You have it even in a very gentle family, like in the Starks, because Bran is 7 years old, I think, when Game of Thrones starts, and one major argument that Eddard has to take him to the beheading is that he can't stay a child forever. And if you have to start growing up in the age of 7, then there can't be much of a childhood going on. Right. And I mean, the squires, they are, I think, what, 9 or 10 years when they start, and they can become knights as early as 15 or 16. So that's all children in our view. But for Westeros, they are not children. They are not really adults either. But it doesn't make a difference for killing them. You have no special feelings towards them as being small. In Westerosi society, children are small adults. They are not as capable, but that doesn't mean anything in and of itself.
Yeah, and it's, you know, even aside from the... I think when you think about it in the books, it's obviously different in the show for various reasons, but I almost think that most of the main characters are minors. Maybe that's exaggerating, but Danny, Rob, Jon, Sansa, Arya, Bran, Joffrey, Margaery, none of them are even 18 years old, I don't think.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, back when he started, and when he killed the Mad King, Jaime was 17, all of that sort of older generation, the Eddard, Catelyn generation, were very young when they got married and started Robert's Rebellion. I don't think they were teenagers, I don't think they were children, per se. But, Westerosi society demands that you grow up very quickly and makes very little allowance for childhood. And that's true of, you know, the real world when society was at a comparable level. You know, childhood was more or less a later invention, let alone what we think of today as teenagers, which is almost, at least in America, was kind of a post-World War II invention. You were a child and then you were a grown-up before that, pretty much.
Yeah, we converted that from the U.S., so we just copied it.
I'm not even talking about that. You're right, you know, talking about, you know, people with ages in the single digits. They're expected to grow up very, very quickly. So it stands to reason, I suppose that, you know, then you're fair game when war does break out. But I think another thing that's a distinction that is, I suppose, important to make is that there are crimes against children that are isolated incidents, and then there are other crimes that are part of a, you know, a purposeful campaign of terror against civilians and against the innocent. And I think the main one, obviously, is what the Lannisters do in the Riverlands. You know, Tywin sends his dogs into the field with the express purpose of terrifying civilians, murdering people, raping people, burning their crops, burning their villages. That's his goal. So he may not have ordered them specifically to go around killing children, but that's, but he, in essence, that's exactly what he did. You know, which is different, I think, from the way that violence against children happens at the hands of Northern forces or, you know, certain of the other factions, where it's not part of a plan, an overall plan of battle. But ultimately, does that really matter if it's your son or daughter who's being murdered? You know, probably not a whole lot. I wouldn't think. You know, and it's coming to terms with that that marks Rob and Daenerys in particular as leaders of good moral character, because I think they understand that what they're doing is going to lead to the death of children, unfortunately, and other innocent people, and it's watching them struggle with that you know, has been fairly fascinating for both characters.
Absolutely. We are just tackling on the direct violence against children yet,
right,
because we have all these murders of children. But there is a whole level of violence against children we haven't touched as yet, and which we are also witnesses of when we read the books. Just think, as a word I'm just throwing into the room, a flea bottom. I mean, there is a whole block within King's Landing that is more or less just tormenting and letting children suffer, because children living in the streets of King's Landing, or any other city for that matter, are subject to violence by their elders, by the city guard, by other children, and this seems like something that isn't even regarded as a problem, but just as the way of the world. Children are subject to poverty in a much harder way than most of the adults are. And in Westeros, at least, nobody really cares about it. And that's an eerie reflection of real world, too, because the street children are one thing that we have in third world countries, too, and which lets the children really suffer. I mean, you just have to look at this movie about the Indian guy who wins the millionaire show, who wants to be a millionaire. Yeah, Slumdog Millionaire was the title. There you have this plight about the street children, and that's today. I mean, must have been really harder in a medieval society where you just can't enjoy some effects of civilization, like toilets, for example, or stuff like that. So it is really a harsh world, and children are the victims of it most of the time.
Yeah, and even in areas that are a little better developed and that are, you know, have a higher level of you know, have sort of more opportunity for children to just get out of, off the street and out of the way. It's still dangerous and demanding and physically draining and cruel. And I think a good example there is even when no one knows that Arya Stark is Arya Stark, she's basically, you know, she's taken prisoner. You know, her guardian is killed. She's captured. She could easily have been tortured to death. You know, she just happened not to be one of the people who was picked. And then she's put to work, you know, as essentially a slave. Now, apparently, Westeros doesn't call it slavery, you know, because she hasn't been purchased and she won't be sold. But she has no choice but to go to work, you know, at Harrenhal on behalf of the Lannisters. And if she screws up, she is beaten. And I think we've seen that's the case everywhere. There's no place where that doesn't happen, as far as I know. You know, and it can be worse depending on who took you prisoner, whether you're in a slave city, or you can be purchased and sold, or whether you're work for the Ironborn, who are brutal. But if I recall correctly, the children of thralls, who are, you know, essentially slaves captured in war, are freed, are they not?
Yeah, they are, but they are still citizens of second class in the Iron Islands.
Right, right. They're like a low caste. So, you know, and that's an almost universal fact of life in Westeros and Essos and the entire world of Ice and Fire. Even in places where it's not as bad as Flea Bottom, where the children are sort of running around almost like feral animals, there are so few safeguards for preserving the welfare of children, because I just don't think they're conceived of, as you say, as deserving of any kind of special treatment. Once you're old enough to walk and talk and feed yourself, you're absolutely right. You're just sort of fair game, and it's a horrifying fact of life.
You don't even have to go as far as Fleet Bottom. If you take the season 2 of Game of Thrones, the Winterfell storyline, we have this example of the orphan boys and other fugitives that cluster to Winterfell, and then there is this guy who has lost his children, and I think it's Bran, who just gives him 2 orphan boys to take with him and regard as his own sons or something. So they are pushed around as chattel too, and their fate is one of the kinder ones you can get as a children in Westeros. I mean,
yeah.
And even that is really hard. You are just given away to some stranger who may or may not be kind to you, or may not abuse you, and there is no one to protect you if he does. And that's one of the better things that can happen to you. I think that says a lot about the world in which they are living and making their way of life.
And, I also think children just get caught up in war wholesale. You know, if your lands happen to be where the battle's being fought, or if you're a wildling child, you've been herded out of your village, you've walked into the middle of nowhere to try and dig up this secret weapon, and then, you know, you are right there on the battlefield, or right behind it, as every adult that you know throws themselves at the wall in hopes that they can get through, because if they fail, you could be killed by the Night's Watch, you could be killed by the others who are, you know, right behind you. There's really no... There's no quarter for children, and I perhaps more than any other aspect of the book, the more that I think about it, the more Martin is sort of getting across, you know, the true nature of war. But it's funny because it's not something that I think even really registers with most characters. It's a message communicated only to us, the readers.
Yes, definitely. The characters, if they would develop a kind of a sensibility towards this topic, they would totally fall out of their role. They would be anachronisms in their own world. So right. that would be bad. This is a sub-story just for the readers, as is the whole the past sub-story that goes on in the novel, because Martin tells the story about the past of Eddard and Aerys and Robert and so on, and that's also not a story the characters are building together. It's a story solely for the reader.
Yeah.
Because you get the bits and pieces of it by different characters. But the point where you say that the children are simply dying, you have it also when there is the talk for Daenerys of taking the Demon Road, crossing the Red Waste. Both are very hostile environments, and they are arguing about crossing them, and it is totally clear that if they do, the weak will die first. So right. There is no chance for any child in this huge host that Danny has assembled that could survive such a journey. And that doesn't really prevent people from suggesting this. I mean, yeah, okay, they will all die, but there are always more children to be had, so let's walk. It's something along these lines.
Yeah.
And it is not really discussed or argued about. I mean, Dany is horror-struck, but Dany isn't typical for a ruler in Westeros. She
right.
isn't even typical for any inhabitant of Westeros. So we can take her as a relative measurement here.
Yeah, as you've brought up in the past, I think in one of our very earliest podcasts, Dany represents a fairly, I mean, not completely radical. She's not considering abolishing the monarchy, at least as far as we know. She wants to be queen, but she is considering and thinking about so many different things than almost any other ruler, with the possible exception of Jon. You know, just in terms of what it means to rule, who your subjects really are, what you owe your subjects. And yeah, her consideration of children, I think, is very different than almost anyone else's. I think a far more typical outlook on the role of children and what we owe children as people in power, as adults in power, is, sad to say, Roose Bolton. You know, children for him is just sort of like insurance, you know, that things will continue to go well and that there'll be security in his little corner of the world. And, you know, he's hoping to have more trueborn sons. But if Ramsay Bolton is nice and secure and will continue the Bolton name, and if Ramsay then turns around and murders his new babies that he's going to have with his Frey wife, then so be it. You know, you know, not everyone is as bloodless about it as he is, but children, for the most part, I think are a means to an end. You know, to perpetuate a bloodline. Or to you know, or to do work, or you know, or yeah, they're not, they're objects, they're not subjects. And you know, it's a very rare, almost visionary leader that can see it any way differently. And I think that separates the issue of the cruelty to children from the issue of cruelty to women, because I think a lot of the characters that we've met, particularly the women characters, are able not just to recognize that there's something systemically wrong with the way these societies treat women, but to actually articulate it. You know, they may not have a solution that we would recognize as feminism, but from Cersei to Dany to Brienne to even Catelyn, they recognize that there's something very wrong with the way women are treated as second-class citizens, and they say so, even if it's just a comment on how it's made life more difficult for them personally, rather than expanding it to a critique of the entire system. But I don't know that we've ever really seen anyone say, like, this is not right, the way that we treat children. I don't even think it occurs to Arya that there's something really profoundly tragic and unfair and unjust about, unfair, yes, about what's happened with her. Unjust, you know, that children shouldn't have to go through what she went through. I, you know, maybe as a child she's not capable of making that realization, but it's very different from how someone like Cersei has described her own plight vis-a-vis being a woman. We just haven't seen that reflected in a concern for the welfare of children overall.
I think the difference you are making between subjects and objects is a real interesting one, because it tells us much about Westerosi society. In this society, most people are just objects and not subjects. You have to meet relatively high standards in order to become an acting entity in this world. Most peasants, for example, or the people you can meet in the streets, they are objects, they are subjects of this lord or that lord. They don't have a will of their own, and if they do, it doesn't matter, because in the moment they try to articulate it, they are beaten down into submission. So you can only be a subject out of your own merits, out of your own will, if you meet certain criteria. For example, you have a sword, that certainly helps, you are a noble, stuff like that. So most people are reduced to the status of objects by the standards of the society. So children, they can't be anything else than objects. For their parents, when they are nobles, they can't be acting subjects, because they are... I'm really getting these words together. They are the subjects of the politics of the house. They are sold, and there are marriage contracts made, right, and there are insurances and stuff, but that all prevents them from being subjects in their own right. And the same is true for most women. They are also sold and objects of marriage treaties and stuff like that. So this is a general problem of the society, that it reduces people from individuals to objects of the will of the few individuals that are left.
Yeah, yeah. And I think maybe it's that, you know, you and I and any other reader as a contemporary human being are capable of seeing so clearly that, you know, that this is not good. But the people within the world basically can't. And I think that, like we said earlier, it's almost like we're receiving a secret message from Martin. Because the issues at stake about, you know, being in control of your own destiny and life in a way that is prevented by all the different aspects, the class aspects and the sex aspects of these fictional societies prevent. It's all so clear when it involves children, because with our sensibilities, you know, our contemporary sensibilities, we recoil in such horror from the idea of abusing or murdering children. You know, I just think it sort of, it encapsulates so much of the message, so much of what Martin is trying to say about what's wrong with the society, the way that violence and these sort of hard, brutally enforced class and sex distinctions tear a society apart and are very bad for all the people in it, including the fortunate ones. The people on the fortunate side of the divide lose a lot as well. And I think by constantly placing violence against children in these sort of key, these sort of quietly key junctures in the narrative, you know, it's almost like just... it's sort of like a flag he's waving that, like, look, what's happening to this child on a micro level is happening to everybody in the books on a macro level. And, you know, to the extent that the books have a sort of philosophical or even political message, I think that's what the message is.
Yeah, I very much hope that George R. R. Martin has put this in more or less consciously as a message to the reader. I would love to talk to him about that instead of asking him for the 1,000th time who is the father of John. yeah, you know what I mean. The interviewers are reading very much alike these days. But in an attempt to wrap this whole discussion up, I think we have at least one beacon of hope left for children in Westeros and in the Song of Ice and Fire books, because at least people who intentionally kill children are abhorred, even in Westeros. Right. To be a murderer of children is something that stands out, even in Westeros. And your reputation suffers, at least, if you have killed children, as witnessed by Amory Lorch or Gregor Clegane. Everyone accepts that it happens, but the people who do it, they are still a little bit more assholes than the rest. And I think at least that can be viewed as a slightly positive trend.
That's true, and that's a great point. I mean, you could now, I could find a negative spin to put on that and say, oh, well, it's everyone's being a hypocrite. because while Gregor Clegane and Amory Lorch are useful, you know, the Lannisters aren't going to do anything about it. If Theon were somehow able to hold Winterfell, I don't think his father would then be like, no, you have to be killed because you killed children. You know, and obviously even the North, although they don't wage that sort of terror campaign deliberately, you know, children will die because the North attacked, and you know, that's inherent in that decision to go to war. So I could be a dick about it and be like, oh, they're just a bunch of hypocrites. But no, you're right. I think it's positive for Westeros. Certainly, when you weigh it against the slave cities and how they are so nonchalant and proud to hurt children, I think you can see why that's one way in which Westeros has sort of a moral leg up on certain other aspects of society, certain other societies in the world. And you're right, it's a sign that if they can recognize that the deliberate slaughter of children, the sort of flagrant way that it's done by Lannister's attack dogs or Theon is wrong, then maybe they can build on that as a foundation for the future. And I think it will depend on who's sitting the Iron Throne in the end. But yeah, you're right. There's reason to hope.
I think at one point we will make a podcast about the topic how Westeros will develop in the next 500 years, and if it will take a similar turn to our own history and the process of civilization, so to speak.
Right.
But that's a topic for a different podcast, and with this, I think we could close it up. So, it always feels a bit forced when we end it, because it always seems like we have so much to talk about, but the proverbial hour is full now, so I guess we have to say goodbye to our listeners for the time being.
And yes, thank you everyone for listening. I know this is some rough stuff that we talked about this episode, so we appreciate your forbearance and your interest, as always. And Stefan, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, thanks. The pleasure is all mine. So, then we will see each other again the next time, and hopefully it will be soon.